What do you see on the horizon for financial markets? From uncertainty to opportunity, PGIM can help you rise to the challenges of today, when disciplined risk management is needed most. With $1.2 trillion in AUM and deep expertise across asset classes, our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Odd Lots podcast. I'm Joe Weisenthal.
And I'm Tracy Alloway.
Tracy, you know what I'm not looking forward to in 2023?
It could be any number of things, but what?
Well, I got a decent price on a rental in where I live in Manhattan.
Right. During the pandemic. Didn't you move during the pandemic?
I did. Like, I got a pretty good pandemic deal. And I am not looking forward. And I think, like, you know, yeah, pretty good rent. I'm worried that at some point, like, my landlord will perceive that, like, there is a gap between what we're paying and what the market prices are, and that my rent bill is going to shoot up.
Well, I got a not very good deal on a rental post-pandemic last year. And I've already gotten my one-year, rent renewal notice. And it was an automatic 5% pay increase, which kind of sucks.
Yeah, that's not great. But wait, you did negotiate with them a little bit?
I did. I said, is there any way we could compromise on the rent? To which their response was, they knocked $75 off of their
proposed hike.
Okay. I'm saving myself $75 a month, which
relative to the counterfactual,
I am grateful for the gesture. However, relative to the substantial New York rent, it's not that much. Okay. But I tried.
So we know that, like, all right, so obviously rent is really important for all kinds of reasons. It's another one of these highly salient prices that people pay. It's a huge component of the inflation measures. What we know about the measures of rent seem to be two things. One is various private sector measures seem to have been turning down for a while. That's clear. And it also seems like it's only a matter of time before that feeds into the official measures that the Fed likes to look at. We had a good episode last year with Omer Sharif talking about why there's that gap and how to think about reconcile these two measures. But, like, how far is it going to come down? Will there be a year in which our rent doesn't go up at all? Will other people in other parts of the country see rent? This is, like, a huge topic. We've never actually done, like, a pure rent episode as far as I know.
No, we haven't. And there are all these interesting little things you can start to pick out of the topic. So, yes. For instance, you know, in New York, maybe rents are starting to come down now, but not nearly as quickly as in other parts of the country.
Yes.
New York is a big part of rent CPI, right? And so if New York prices stay sticky, it could have an overall effect on national rent prices. And also, I'm interested in talking also about some of the big picture developments that we have seen in the space. You know, people talk a lot about private equity moving into multifamily housing, whether or not that's pushing up prices, the impact of new technology as well on how landlords actually come up with the prices that they charge people for their buildings. Lots to talk about.
Well, you know, and we did talk about this recently with Connor Sen, who I thought made a really fascinating point, which is that, like, the rent, like apartment rent specifically, multifamily housing, it just has gone from strength to strength over the last, like, 15 years. You know, it's like after the great financial crisis, no one's going to want to own a home anymore. Let's rent.
Right.
Millennials don't want to live in the suburbs. Let's move to the city and rent. Millennials are delaying having kids. Let's, you know, no reason to, you know, more rent. Like, at every turn, multifamily dwellings have won. And there's this boom. And if you do a chart showing construction in multifamily versus construction in single family, single family is totally slumped, never got even back to anywhere near like pre-crisis levels, whereas multifamily just keeps booming.
Yeah.
Is that a permanent thing, or could like there be like this sort of like Minsky moment for multifamily and for rental options where it's like the luck suddenly runs out?
Right. And so much of the market right now, housing in general, so single family plus multifamily, so much of the outlook is predicated on what you think is going to happen to supply and capacity.
Yes.
So that is really a key question. Are the multifamily homes going to keep getting built?
Well, let's talk about it with someone who can answer all of these questions for us. We are going to be speaking with Chris Salviati. He is the senior housing economist at Apartment List. He's going to answer our questions. Chris, thank you so much for coming on Odd Lots.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
So, Chris, can I ask my landlord for a rent cut when in the next couple months? Like, is that reasonable?
Well, I guess it depends when you signed your lease, Joe. It sounded like you got kind of one of those pandemic deals that, you know, particularly in New York City, that was one of the markets where rents actually fell really sharply in that first year of the pandemic. So we are really seeing the market having turned a corner a little bit over these past few months. Prices have been coming down for 4 straight months now in our national rent index.
Wow.
But, you know, if you're still paying that late 2020 level, then you might not necessarily be eligible for a discount at this point.
Good point.
So when we say rents are going down, and I saw on your Twitter feed, I think you have the national median rent down now 3% from its August 2022 peak. What does that actually mean? Like, how are we actually putting together a national or, you know, even a city rent price? And I guess my question really is, when prices start to move like that, how much of it is reflected in the actual figures that people are paying for their apartments?
The way that we calculate our price index, it's basically a repeat transaction index. And so we can see, you know, on our platform, we're able to track individual units over time. So we can see for all of the apartments that were listed on Apartment List for rent this month and that subsequently got rented, we can look back and see when was the last time that that exact unit was rented previously, compare those two prices and see how much that price changed for that individual unit, which really, you know, controls for sort of quality across the inventory. And then we basically aggregate those up for the individual geography, whether that be a city level or a national level index. And our national index is basically just an aggregation of all the inventory that we see across the country. And so that, you know, 3% discount that we talked about starting from the August peak to present, that should be reflective of what folks are seeing if you're going out on the market and signing a new lease.
So as an economist, I mean, you know, I guess like there's like the index construction, as you described it, I'm sure it's a, you know, I'm sure that's a pretty tricky technical challenge. And, you know, we had that conversation last year with Omer Sharif. There's these, coming up with the price index is never trivial, even if it's just like a sort of like repeat methodology. But I'm curious, like, from a modeling perspective, like, okay, strength of the consumer, strength of the labor market has got to be like one important factor. If people are losing jobs, if people's wages are going down, there's like got to be a limit to how much rent price increase can be sustained. What else goes into that supply? Like, how do you think about sort of like modeling a forecast for the price of rent?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think in the at the highest level framework, it is, as you said, kind of a demand and supply question.
Yeah.
I think when we talk about housing, you know, obviously the supply response is a lot more prolonged than it is maybe in some other markets. You know, it takes a long time to permit and get new construction built. And so in the short term, you know, I think the kind of the big up and down swings that we see are really driven by demand. And when we're talking about demand here, it's really household formation. You know, how many new people are striking out on their own and forming new households. And obviously when we're talking about the rental market in particular, there's also the dynamics of how that household formation kind of interacts between the for sale and the rental side of the market. So, you know, right now what we're seeing, obviously sky high mortgage rates, things are really difficult on the for sale side as well. And so folks are staying in rental units for longer, that creates tightness, but the overall household formation numbers. You know, if we go back to 2021, that's when that was really, you know, taking off, and when we saw the really astronomical rent hikes over the past year, and particularly the past few months, that's really started to slow down quite a bit.
See on the horizon for financial markets. From uncertainty to opportunity, PGIM can help you rise to the challenges of today when disciplined risk management is needed most. With $1.2 trillion in AUM and deep expertise across asset classes, our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
So one thing I've always wondered, are rent hikes and rent decreases sort of asymmetrical in the sense that rents tend to go up a lot faster than they come down? This is my, you know, at the risk of being very biased here, but my personal experience with rent is that it tends to go up and doesn't tend to come down as much. Is that actually the case?
Yeah, you know, when we look at our rent index over time, it's definitely the case that it tends to march upward rather than downward. We do see, it is typical to see a little bit of a decline in the late fall and winter months. There's just a pretty clear seasonal pattern to rent trends, and fewer folks move in the winter. So properties that do have vacancies to fill will often offer modest discounts at that time of year. But again, that is really just kind of a temporary seasonal trend. And, you know, at once activity picks back up, rent growth tends to turn positive again. And that positive growth almost always outweighs those seasonal declines. You know, our rent index goes back to 2017. So we don't have a huge history, but at least over those years, we've never seen a year in which nominal rent growth has been negative. Even if you go back to the aftermath of the Great Recession and you look at rent CPI over that period, you know, it was basically flat. We didn't really see much of a nominal decline there either.
So just on this topic, I imagine that you must speak to landlords on a fairly regular basis. What's the decision process for them like when it comes to setting the rents? Like, what are they looking at? What are the different factors that might go into them actually pulling the trigger on either a substantial rent hike or some sort of decline?
You know, I should say a lot of the inventory that we have on apartment list in particular, and that feeds into our rent index, it does tend to skew towards a particular segment of the market, that being, you know, the large professionally managed multifamily complexes. So thinking here of, you know, big apartment buildings that have 50 or more units. And so those professionally managed buildings tend to be pretty sophisticated in how they set prices. And actually, there are price setting algorithms, softwares that kind of tend to come bundled along with property management softwares. And so a lot of these properties are actually, you know, using these kind of algorithmic price setting techniques where, you know, the software that they're using is also kind of integrated with various other properties throughout the market. And so they have a lot of really good real-time data on, you know, those demand changes as they see them in real time. And so I think, you know, when we're talking about this professionally managed segment, I think it can be pretty sophisticated. Obviously, at the other end of the spectrum, you've got your, you know, your kind of mom and pop landlords, folks who maybe only own a couple of rental units. And I think that segment of the market, maybe the considerations are a little bit different, probably a little bit slower to respond to those market changes, and also probably a greater emphasis on just wanting to avoid vacancies, right, and then having tenants that will be there for a long time. So it definitely varies based on, you know, the part of the market that you're talking about.
I actually wanted to bring, it's sort of getting a little bit away from the macro, but that's fine. You know, like, it always seems to me when I think about this question, which is that if you have a tenant who is both good at like regularly paying their bills, is not regularly late, has never had an issue where they need to be evicted or something, there seems like there must be like a pretty big risk in pricing them out, because A, like, it doesn't take very long of a vacant apartment, it would seem to me, it wouldn't take very long to lose a lot of the gains you would get from the rent price increase. So if you have like a month vacancy, that's a lot of lost money. And then there's the wild card of like, okay, then you fill it, but what if the person who comes in is like not great about paying the rent or gonna damage the place? And so I'm curious, like, whether some of the software, these pricing decisions, like, take into account about like existing tenant quality and the potential like cost of losing them.
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. As far as kind of the algorithmic portion of it, you know, those are sort of proprietary algorithms. Sure. And, you know, it's not something that, you know, we had apartmentless, we don't have kind of a version of that. So I don't actually have a good sense of whether or not, you know, this dynamic that we're talking about as far as kind of tenant quality, I'm not sure exactly how that kind of factors into those algorithmic price setting. But as you said, you know, I think this is definitely an important variable. I think in particular, like I said, when we're referring to the kind of the mom and pop segment of the rental space, I think that's probably, you know, factoring a lot more heavily into their decision making. If you've got, you know, if you're a big property owner that has hundreds of units and you lose, you know, one good tenant and have a vacancy that maybe sits for a few months, that's not going to really affect the bottom line as much as if you have, you know, a single duplex and one of your tenants leaves and you have a vacancy for months or have a bad experience with a tenant. And so I think that's also why, you know, maybe prices tend to be a little bit stickier for in those kind of smaller rental properties as well. You know, if those mom and pop landlords do get a good tenant in, I think they want to keep that person there as long as possible. And so maybe they're a little bit more hesitant to really raise prices significantly.
Right. Tracy, I just want to point out, I really like my landlord.
You love your landlord?
She's very attentive. We have a very good relationship. So even though I started the episode saying I was anxious, if she is listening to this, I hope she hears that I really enjoy where we live and I really enjoy our the landlord.
She should factor your consistency into her pricing algorithm.
We've never been, yes, exactly.
Excellent. Okay, Chris, just on this topic, I mean, I do find this fascinating. So let me ask about this in a slightly different way, which is, over the past few years, given the rise of some of these algorithmic pricing services, given also the rise of the number of big landlords who seem to be moving into the multifamily space or becoming a bigger part of that space, do you see an impact on prices? So for instance, are they more volatile, more reactive than they used to be when we maybe had a rental landscape that was more about small mom and pop landlords?
That definitely could be the case, that we're seeing a little bit more of volatility, kind of bigger swings in either direction in rent prices. I think one kind of piece of evidence that's maybe kind of interesting and relevant here, the Cleveland Fed actually put out a really interesting working paper recently where they dug into, you know, you mentioned kind of briefly that this difference between the trends that you would see in our rent index versus what's happening in the official CPI measures. And so this paper was really meant to kind of like disentangle those differences. And so what they did was essentially take the underlying microdata that feeds into the official CPI estimates and reconstructed an alternate index that's using a methodology similar to how apartmentlist and other kind of private sector sources calculate our rent indexes. So essentially looking at, you know, rather than all households, looking at only new tenants and using kind of a repeat rent methodology similar to ours. And so what that found was basically that this kind of new index that they constructed follows a very similar trend to what we see in our index, but the swings are a little bit less extreme. And I do think that probably this comes down to the difference in sample. As I said, you know, the apartmentless index is heavily skewed towards this large professionally managed segment of the market, whereas the BLS data is designed to be representative of the market as a whole. And so that kind of suggests to me that we are seeing, you know, a bit of kind of what you described, that these that the large professionally managed buildings are going to be a little bit more reactive in their pricing, and that those swings, as I said, you know, when rents are going up, they might go up a little bit quicker. And when they're going down with that seasonal trend, those winter dips might be a little bit more pronounced as well. You know, it could also be the case that there is maybe just different demand dynamics happening at different segments of the market. So this might not all come down to just that kind of algorithmic pricing alone, but I do think it's certainly a factor there.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the picture right now and what's happening, because so we had this huge rent boom. Everyone knows the price of rent surged, especially basically all the measures, private measures, public measures, etc. Everything went up a lot. But it seems like there are a number of factors now that, and we've touched on some of them, that are reversing. So the labor market is slowing, wage growth is slowing, new job creation is not what it was a year ago. Household formation, as you mentioned, that boomed, and now there's already some talk about, like, okay, well, maybe like people are getting roommates again, which, as we talked about, I think it was with James Egan, that's like a factor in shrinking household formation. I didn't understand all these terms until just a few months ago when we talked about that. But so that's shrinking household formation. And then, you know, and we talked about it in the intro, the multifamily industry just like booming, and those construction numbers don't seem to have slowed down at all yet. And so, like, how much of like a sort of like confluence of factors could there be, or how unusual of a situation could be where there's a number of potential drivers of reduced demand, and at the same time the supply creation has been off the charts? Like, what do you see happening with this combo of drivers?
Yeah, you know, as I said, we've been seeing already that our national rent index has been declining for the past 4 months. You know, as I said, that all in and of itself isn't necessarily atypical, but the decline that we've been seeing recently has been notably sharper than the usual seasonal trend. And so it does seem like some of these factors are finally kind of colliding and coming to fruition in a way that's really resulting in a big shift in the market. And I do think, you know, it's really kind of the things that you just laid out there. On the demand side, things really are cooling down quite a bit. Obviously, you know, after a year plus of extreme skyrocketing rent growth, as well as just broad-based inflation eating away at non-housing budgets, folks are finding that their budgets just aren't going as far. And so fewer folks are able to afford to strike out on their own. Also with, you know, kind of, as you said, kind of a cooling labor market, recession fears, even people that maybe could currently afford to strike out there on their own are possibly delaying those moves. And so demand has really cooled down significantly. And on the supply side, we are seeing really, as you said, a historic boom there. We've got right now more multifamily units under construction than at any point since 1970. Wow. A lot of that supply is expected to hit the market in 2023. And so I do think that, you know, we aren't necessarily expecting to see a prolonged slide in rents, but I think these days of, you know, extreme rent growth are definitely behind us.
Why is that construction boom happening? Because for the past few years, you would have expected, I mean, we talk a lot about, on the show, about supply chain issues, how that impacted housing. You saw the big gap between single family housing starts and completions, supposedly because of a lot of supply chain issues. You, at a minimum, you would have expected some big multifamily builders or investors to have a more uncertain outlook for the past 2 or 3 years. But that doesn't seem to have translated into any sort of construction slowdown. So why is that?
You know, I think despite kind of the factors that you mentioned, the outlook for multifamily has continued to remain pretty strong. And I think even as we talk about the market slowing down a little bit over these past few months, that's still a very minor decline when we think about it relative to what's happened over the past couple of years. So prices down 3% from the August peak, but still up 20% compared to their March 2020 level. And so, you know, we have really seen that that rent prices are continuing to go up. And over the long run, we are seeing strong demand. And so I think that is creating kind of, a, you know, maintaining sort of a positive outlook for the multifamily industry. And
can I ask this question in a slightly different way? Like, what is the bull case for multifamily here? Like, why, like, what gives these big investors the confidence to keep building at the rate that we've seen recently?
Yeah, so I mean, I think when we just look kind of holistically, it's definitely the case that the U.S. housing market is still undersupplied. You know, there are kind of various estimates out there on how big that gap is. But Freddie Mac, for example, estimates that we're have a shortage of about 4 million housing units right now. And, you know, we are still seeing kind of more and more of, you know, obviously millennials are the largest generation, but Gen Z is also a large generation that's continuing to come of age and to form their own households. And there is still a lot of pent up demand there, I think, in terms of, you know, new household formation that we could see going forward. And so I think that's really kind of the, I say macro level, I guess that would be kind of the broad picture. I think a lot of this also varies geographically as well.
Yeah.
A lot of this construction is happening in Sunbelt markets, and in those markets in particular have been continuing to draw really, really strong demand.
Yeah, I was just going to ask actually that question, because you can like point on a chart to production of new apartments going up, but of course it's not really a commodity, because you know, new apartments being built in Nashville or Dallas don't help me as a renter in New York City. Can you talk a little bit more about the geographical distribution of where this new supply is coming up?
As I said, a lot of this is coming in the Sunbelt market. So when we look at, you know, new permitting activity per capita, so how many new housing units are being permitted as a proportion of the existing number of housing units in a given market, Austin is far and away the leader there. But the really, you know, the ones that are seeing kind of the most permitting activity are really a lot of those Texas markets, Florida market, Phoenix, and the big coastal, you know, superstar cities. In contrast, places like New York, San Francisco, Boston, we're really not seeing that same level of activity. And so the markets that, you know, are kind of the nation's most expensive ones, the ones that have been undersupplied for so long, we are continuing to see that be a problem where they are still underbuilding.
Just in terms of, I guess, the factors and motivations that drive apartment construction, can you talk to us a little bit about financing? Like, what is a typical financing structure if I want to build a big, you know, apartment building of some sort? Do I take out, you know, a floating rate loan, or am I so big that maybe I'm issuing my own bonds? Like, how does that actually work?
You know, that's a great question that isn't necessarily my particular area of expertise.
Okay, so, that's fair.
I don't have the concrete details there. But, you know, I will say that when we talk about kind of single family versus multifamily construction, obviously single family has slowed down quite a bit recently. And that is in response to sort of rising interest rates, obviously hit mortgages as well. And so the rising interest rates really hit demand on the single family side in a way that they don't on the multifamily side.
Yeah, that was kind of my question.
Project, yeah. And multifamily projects, I would also say, are just kind of bigger and more complex and are endeavors that unfold over a longer period of time. And so maybe a little bit less reactive to those kind of short-term fluctuations in the market.
Are back, and so is all the Credit, PGIM Fixed Income's monthly podcast series. From the latest trends to long-term perspectives, you'll get timely fixed income insights from leading economists, research analysts, and investment professionals. Whether you're new to bonds or a seasoned investor, tune in to All the Credit wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast is intended solely for professional investor use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
I want to go back to, you know, we talked about household formation, or maybe, well, I don't know, household deformation lately, and maybe people get roommates again, they're feeling a little less confident. Another like sort of, maybe it's like medium term trend, and it seems like during the pandemic, we did start to see a bit of a millennial baby boom, my understanding. And so I guess when people have kids, they're like, well, maybe we'll move out of the city, move out of a multi-family. This actually, I already have a second question. But the first question is, like, how does that factor into it? And again, you know, we were talking about, I said in the beginning, like, all these things have been going in good for multifamily developers. Could this be like a meaningful, like, medium term setback if there's some sort of structural shift among millennials, pretty huge generation right now, in which actually, you know what, we thought we were cool, but in the end, we ended up boring like everyone else and we moved out to the suburbs?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think that is actually something that we've already been seeing play out in our data, is this kind of shift away from the downtown areas and towards the suburbs to a certain extent. When we look at our rent data and break that out by, you know, the core cities of major metros, yeah, versus their surrounding suburbs, we've actually found that since the start of the pandemic, rent growth has been notably faster in the suburbs of big metros as compared to the core cities. So I think some of this, you know, is maybe due to just changing preferences because of the pandemic itself. Folks, you know, maybe not feeling as safe in the early phases of the pandemic, being in a dense urban environment, wanting to space out a little bit more. Remote work is also a factor here. But as you said, I think, you know, the millennial generation is now aging into this phase of wanting to settle down and start families. And so, you know, I think we definitely are starting to see some of those shifts already start to play out.
All right, I have another question, which is like, so I have two kids, but unlike other people, I actually am cool and I don't want to move to the suburbs.
Like, this episode is just Joe taking like advice on handling his rent.
No, this is going to be a gripe. This is a gripe. Okay. Like, I don't want to move to the suburbs. I like living in Manhattan. That being said, you know, every once in a while when we look like at new developments and they're like, oh, really cool, and they have like a pool room and they have like a doorman, which is all stuff I've never had before. They're like terrible for families, and none of these buildings have like, you know, like they'll like call it a two bedroom and the second bedroom will like be a closet. Like, really, and then like, God forbid, like a third bedroom or something, like you never find it. Why is it that like all of this like new development that we see, like none of it seems like suitable for people with kids?
That's a good question too. I think, you know, it has been the case that historically we do see these kind of shifts, that, you know, as folks kind of age into that phase of life of settling, yeah, down and having kids, you know, that has been a pretty predictable pattern, that, you know, the majority of folks move out of the city and towards the suburbs. Right. And so I think historically, maybe that demand just hasn't necessarily been there as much. But I do think that, you know, we are also seeing that, as I said, we've been seeing some of these kind of shifts out of the city. But I do think that we have also seen that millennials have kind of different preferences as well, and probably have a little bit more of a desire for those urban amenities than potentially prior generations. And so I think hopefully that will be something where the supply side starts to come around and maybe cater to that segment of the market a little bit more. But historically, I think maybe that just hasn't necessarily been the case as much. And so potentially properties kind of working on a little bit of an outdated model, yeah, potentially on what folks are desiring.
Let me ask a really basic, simple question that we probably should have asked at the very beginning, but how low could rents go from here?
Good question.
What's the outlook?
So I think, you know, our base case for this year is that we're not really expecting to see a decline for full year 2023. We're probably expecting to see very modest positive rent growth, maybe a couple of percentage points. But I think there is the possibility that rents could continue to slide, particularly if we do enter a recession this year, if the labor market continues to weaken and, you know, we do enter a phase where there's possibly a contraction in household that maybe reverses some of this household formation that's happened in recent years. There is certainly the possibility that rents could continue to trend downward. As I said, that's not really the base case that I'm working with right now. And even if rents were to continue sliding in, you know, that downside scenario where potentially we enter a recession, I don't think we're talking about declines anywhere near the magnitude that would reverse the increases that we saw in, say, 2021.
What's the biggest wild card or the most important factor in that outlook? Like, what would give you reason to pause and say, actually, maybe things could go in a different direction? Is it something like, you know, if there's a recession and unemployment picks up, or something like if capacity suddenly booms even more? Like, what is that pressure point for the outlook?
I would say it really is probably just what's happening in the broader macro environment and in the labor market in particular. As I said, you know, we've got kind of record number of new units in the construction pipeline. So the supply side of it seems pretty clear that we are going to get a lot of new supply coming online this year. And I think the demand side is maybe a little bit more of an X factor. As we've looked at these past few months of economic data, obviously inflation has already started to come down. There's maybe some brightening signs that potentially the Fed can achieve, you know, this soft landing that they've been talking about. But at the same time, you know, there is still this sort of recession risk, and consumer sentiment, even if it's rebounded a little bit, is still not great. And so I think that really is, you know, probably the biggest thing that I'll be keeping an eye on. If the labor market continues to weaken and we see heightened unemployment, then that's definitely something that we would expect to impact the demand side of the equation. And that would maybe be the case where rents continue to slide.
You know, I just want to actually go back to the recent decline and in historical context, because you said, right, you know, it's not that weird to get a few of these soft months. The most recent prints do seem to be a little bit more on the unusual, unseasonal side. What are some past comparisons? Yep. Like, what are we talking about in terms of, like, what prior downturns looked like? If at the end of 2023, you're like, wow, this really did turn out to be a very different year, it was a bad year. Like, what are we talking about in terms of, like, magnitude, and how far do you have to, like, go back before in time to, like, see, to understand this context?
As I said, you know, when we talk about the recent declines, August through December, down 3%. The past 3 months of rent declines are actually, you know, in the history of our index, which, like I said, we're going back to 2017 here. These past 3 months, October, November, December, those are the three sharpest declines in the history of our national rent index. For comparison, you know, that 3% decline that we've seen over these past few months is in comparison to, say, a more, you know, normal year of 2018 or 2019, we were seeing a decline of maybe 1.5% over that same stretch of months. And so definitely, you know, sharper right now than what we've typically seen. As far as, you know, what happens in kind of times of sort of broader economic downturns, you know, we don't really have the longer history in our index to be able to give the direct comparison there. But as I said, you know, if you look at just rent CPI, obviously that's a little bit of a different measure than our index. But even in the aftermath of the 2008 recession, there wasn't really a significant decline there. It was basically just flat for a couple of years. So, you know, at least in nominal terms, we weren't seeing prices come down by a significant amount. Again, because of the differences in how it's tracked in CPI versus our index, we probably were talking about a little bit of a decline in new lease prices. But I think, you know, to answer your question, just in terms of magnitudes of, you know, how much could things come down, I think even in that downside scenario, if, you know, if we were to enter a recession on the national level, you know, maybe 5%, I would say 10% would feel pretty extraordinary to me. Obviously, again, this is something that varies market by market. So some markets could definitely see sharper declines.
It's really that fact that the great financial crisis, that rents didn't actually, they just stalled, but they didn't even plunge. That kind of makes me believe that they're sort of like, you know, every episode we've done for years is like lessons from the crisis, right? Mm-hmm. In some way. And the lesson for multifamily from the crisis is that it never goes down, which kind of makes me believe that that's sort of like one day that Minsky moment, hard landing, could come from for the industry. Anyway, Chris Salviati, economist at Apartment List, thank you so much for coming on Odd Lots, helping us to finally address a topic that we should have probably touched on a long time ago.
Thanks so much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Tracy, I just want to start off by reiterating that I have a very good landlord. She is very responsive when there are issues in the apartment with appliances, et cetera, and that I hope she's listening and how much we appreciate her responsiveness and, yeah, anyway. I just want to get that out of the way again.
The fact that you keep addressing your landlord, who may or may not listen to this episode, makes me think that actually maybe the landlord has a decent amount of pricing power here.
Oh.
And the more you say it, the more she's going to realize this.
Oh, you're right. I'm like totally backing myself into a corner by, I'm showing my hand how much we want to stay in the unit.
Hey, you should be like, I don't care. I like moving.
Whatever. I like
moving. Bureaucracy,
there's plenty
paperwork,
of good options.
Hassle,
all of these new buildings have great amenities that I can use. You're right.
No, I'm but my major takeaway from that discussion is that it's good to be a landlord.
Yeah.
And it seems good to be a multifamily landlord. There is a big question mark that you kept alluding to about whether or not at some point the boom in the expansion, the supply side expansion, whether or not that will come home to roost. But it seems, I don't know, like given the structural lack of housing in the US, it seems like we're a long way off from that.
I'll tweet out the chart when this episode comes out so people know, but like we have this index, US multifamily units started for rent. And it's just so far above pre-Great Financial Crisis. I mean, it's way above pre-COVID levels, pre-financial crisis. The last time it was this high, at least on this index, looks like it was like 1986.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, this is just like an industry that just wins. But I do think, you know, like, again, I do remember we probably read, maybe even wrote, like, some stories like, oh, well, millennials be scarred on owning homes forever in 2010. And that was a popular thing. And now, like, you know, everyone got boring and they had kids and they moved out to the suburbs and they bought a house if they could. And so I do wonder, I do like buy this idea, like maybe some big shift is going to happen.
You know what's interesting? If you chart that line, multifamily units started for rent versus multifamily units started for sale.
Oh.
It two very different directions. So this for sale ones is just plunges and the for rent one just keeps going up.
Oh, that's a great chart.
You know, yes, we should definitely write that, not just tweet about it.
Yeah, no, you're right. Wow, I never looked at this. There's plenty on this.
The other thing that surprised me.
Well, you know what? Wait, can I just say, actually, before I bring up, you know, it's interesting, and I don't know if this chart exists, but I think the flip side is that there has been an increase in single family units for rent, which is not a category of housing that gets a lot of discussion, but it is a growing sector of like single family household units, but for the rental market. Anyway, I think that actually is a, there's some interesting stuff here to explore further.
For sure. And you know the other thing that surprises me about that whole episode?
Yes.
We managed to get through it without once saying that the rent is too damn high, which I thought one of us was for sure going to bring
you
up.
You just took care of that for us.
Yeah, okay, I did it. Shall we leave it there?
Let's leave it there.
Okay. This has been another episode of the Odd Lots podcast. I'm Tracy Alloway. You can follow me on Twitter at Tracy Alloway.
And I'm Joe Weisenthal. You can follow me on Twitter at The Stalwart. Follow our guest, Chris Salviati. He's at Chris_Salviati. Follow our producers, Carmen Rodriguez at Carmen Arman and Dash Bennett at Dashbot. And check out all of our podcasts at Bloomberg under the handle at podcasts. And for more Odd Lots content, go to Bloomberg.com/oddlots, where we post transcripts. Tracy and I blog, and we have a weekly newsletter that comes out every Friday. Go there, give us your email, and sign up for it. Thanks for listening.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.